Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by The Isley Brothers, The Carpenters, The Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hey, this is Trevor from Halifax calling in to say that I support Creative Control on Patreon because I think long-form arts journalism is a crucial part of music culture and there's simply not enough of it out there today. Vish is a master interviewer, he lands great guests, and he has his finger on the pulse of the ever-changing music landscape both here in Canada and abroad. For all of these reasons and many more, I think you should support Creative Control on Patreon too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Visha's wife, and I will love him no matter what you do, and now he has me on the record saying that.
The Replacements was an American rock and roll band formed in Minneapolis, Minnesota in 1979. Originally featuring Paul Westerberg, Tommy Stinson, Chris Mars, and the late Bob Stinson, the Mats initially broke up in 1991 after releasing seven excellent albums, including 1987's Please to Meet Me. On October 9th, 2020, Rhino Records is reissuing Please to Meet Me as a 3-CD, 1-LP deluxe box set which tells the story of this significant album in ways not previously possible with more than 50% of the content previously unreleased. Bob Mayer is a music writer who first appeared on this show in 2016 to discuss his wonderful book, Trouble Boys, The True Story of the Replacements, and he has written the compelling liner notes for this edition of Please to Meet Me. Jason Jones is an A&R man at Rhino Records, who specializes in overseeing deluxe box sets like the recent one for Funhouse by the Stooges, and for those currently in circulation by The Replacements, one of his all-time favorite bands. I connected with Bob and Jason recently, and we had an extensive conversation about Please to Meet Me, the story behind its unique production, their take on the band and the 29 unreleased songs in this collection, what might be next for The Replacements and this archive series, future plans, and more. A part of the Entertainment One Network, with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, and Massey Hall's concert film series live at masseyhall.com, where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like The New Pornographers, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 569th episode of Creative Control, featuring Massive Replacements fans and experts Bob Mayer and Jason Jones, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Jason. How's it going?
It's going well, Vish. How are you?
I'm well. It's nice to speak with you. First of all, where in the world are you?
I am in Los Angeles, California right now.
Ah, how are things going in Los Angeles, California, as we're speaking?
It's a little warm, we're still, our AQI is still up and down a little bit, so it's definitely been an interesting time. But everything's well. You can't complain in California too much. You have a high chance for a beautiful day just about every day.
Well, I appreciate the climate update. What about the socio-political climate? That's kind of where I was sort of coming from. As we're speaking, your leader and his wife have just been diagnosed with the COVID-19. Virus, and I stayed up late watching your cable news networks to try and figure that out. How are people feeling? Have you talked to anyone about this? What's going on? What's the feeling about this?
I have only seen reactions on social media, and it's definitely been interesting.
Yeah,
because I've seen both sides of the spectrum. We live in weird times right now.
Yeah. Yeah,
and you know, I feel like as we get closer to November, it's only going to get weirder.
Yes. Yes. Yes, I agree. I do agree. All right. Well, it's nice to see and meet you. We'll get more information about who you are in just a moment, but I don't want to leave our other friend here waiting too long. Bob, are you there? Can you hear us?
I am, and I can hear you, Vish. How are you?
I'm well. It's nice to see you again. We chatted how many years ago now about your...
Four and a half, I think, just about.
4.5 years.
2016.
Yes, and that was about your excellent book about The Replacements, Trouble Boys. Is that still doing okay? Is that book doing well?
It's doing okay. I mean, it's not Clive Cussler or who is it, Stephen King, but you know, it's you know, holding its own over the years. It's kind of interesting, just the story of the band, the legend of the band, sort of continues to build, and you know, which is a good thing for me and for them. So
I meant to message you, and I'm sure many people did, because I was watching probably MSNBC or something, and Beto O'Rourke was on there on the TV, and everyone, you guys didn't really do it, but everyone, when they do these virtual things, they put their bookshelves behind them. I've noticed that. There you go. There's your books. I see your books. I see your books, but it seems very point, like, hey, I've got books. I know what I'm talking about. I read something these books. So I noticed that on Beto's very full bookshelf, your book. Did you hear about this?
I didn't know about that. I've had actually a few politicians, you know, very somewhat famously in 2016 when Tim Kaine was on the Democratic ticket as vice president. He not only had read my book, but talked it up in a couple of interviews with the local paper in Minneapolis and with Rolling Stone. So I knew he was a fan, and he's actually done some sort of appearances with former Replacements members. But yeah, I do have to admit that I now in the age of COVID, where you do see all the bookshelves, the bookshelf porn behind people during interviews and stuff, I am constantly I am constantly looking for my book, which is sort of easy to identify. And I've seen a couple political pundits on our news shows with it, but I didn't know Beto had it. But that doesn't surprise me about Beto, since he's a kind of punk, post-punk guy.
That's what he kind of presents himself as such. Has talked about Ian MacKaye and Discord Records. So yeah, no, it makes sense. What do you suppose it is? Since we're here, gathered here today to talk about the Replacements again. I will identify your roles in this Please to Meet Me reissue in a moment. But what is it about the Replacements and politicians, rebellious politicians maybe? Why does this band and their story perhaps resonate with these types of people there, Bob?
It's funny you say that, because I've actually found that, yeah, there's some politicians, but it's more actually comedians. A really incredible number of comedians have responded, or people in the comedy world, you know, from the guys and the kids in the hall to Bob Odenkirk, to Bill Hader and Fred Armisen have read the book, people like that. So I think there is a kind of anarchic sort of comedy troupe spirit about the Replacements. You know, as much as they played music, their sort of presentation, there certainly was a heavy dose of comedy. So I do think there's a comedic thing. I think with the politicians, it's probably more a generational thing. People who are now able to run for office are probably 45 and up. Particularly if they're from the Midwest, as a lot of our, politicians are, or national politicians have been recently. I think there's just, they were in college or in high school and in college when the Replacements were going strong. So it seems to me that they were, part of that, the Replacements college audience, which they had a, pretty hefty, sizable audience there. So I don't know if that's so much politicians being attracted to the band as much as it is they sort of grew up listening to them. But I do think there are sort of segments of the populations, as I mentioned, comedians being one of them, that really seem to gravitate to the Replacements kind of style of anarchy.
Well, comedians, the ones you cited in particular, there's a perfect storm of talent, insecurity, emotional scarring, self-sabotage, rebelliousness, anti-authority. Who better exemplifies that than the Replacements or the kids in the hall?
Right. Well, I think there's something about, comedy troupes in particular, who understand the dynamics of a rock and roll band. And again, all those other things you said, I think stand-up comedians and comedians, sketch comedians, maybe more than other sort of people in other segments of show business, they do have much more of that kind of chip on their shoulder, anti-authoritarian thing that's sort of part and parcel with what they do.
Yeah.
So that all makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's good to talk to you again. And here we are again, 4.5 years later, here to talk about the Replacements. So I think you and I need other topics. I think we need other things to talk about. I think that would be good just for our relationship.
Someday soon, yes, hopefully.
I hope so. Now let's go back to Jason. As I say, we're here to talk about the Please to Meet Me reissue. Jason, I guess very simply, what is your job? Where do you work and what do you do, first of all?
Okay, right on. I am director of A&R for Rhino Entertainment, which is the catalog arm of Warner Music Group. So this would be inclusive of all of the labels that fall within the Warner Music Group umbrella. That's Warner, Atlantic, Elektra, and via Warner, Sire. So this is, I have the good fortune of being able to dig into the history and material from records in our archives and artists and records that we control. On my very first day at Rhino, I had the pleasure of being assigned the what eventually became the Dead Man's Pop box set that came out last year via Rhino. Mm-hmm. And shortly thereafter, I think it was a day or two, or maybe it was my first day, I actually met Bob on my very first day, which for me, I've been a Replacements fan since I was 12 years old.
Yeah.
Or so.
Yeah.
So it really is a dream come true. Be able to work with Bob and work on the catalog of, for me, one of the bands that means the most to me. In addition to the Replacements, I've also produced reissues for the Stooges. I just put together a Funhouse 50th Anniversary Edition huge box
set. Yeah, congrats on that. And I don't know if there's any left. I had it in my cart, and then I got some bills, and I was like, I might have to hold up on that.
We sold out of that one.
It's gone. Yeah, I should have probably. Congrats. It looked very comprehensive. I want to ask you about the replacements in a moment, but your I guess affinity for the historical. I think that's relevant to today's conversation. As a music fan, what is it about presenting the history and in a lot of cases, warts and all, comprehensive history of a band or a record they made? Why does that appeal to you? Why is that of interest to you? And why? Yeah, like you probably could do anything you want. You're digging into the past a lot. Why is that?
Well, initially, I was drawn to catalog from a very young age, mainly because of my disdain for modern music.
What era are we talking about here? What era was...
We're talking about early 90s. Okay. I mean, I was, you know, exposed to punk rock at a very young age. Never mind the Boxers, the Sex Pistols when I was 11 years old. You can see, you know, my class photo the year before I heard that record and the year afterwards. You can see the change in my eyes from what that record did to me.
Punk.
So I think
it's a real it's a revelation. It does open your eyes, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It does. And I had the good fortune of growing up in kind of the burgeoning age of reissue culture via labels like Ryko Disc and Rhino and a few others that, you know, really kind of took stock of what the history of music looked like and what could be expanded upon. So that's kind of, you know, from a very young age, I was exposed to, you know, deluxe editions of classic albums. And that's just always been in my DNA. And that's always been something that I've always been drawn to. I like the storytelling around it. I like the very the thoroughness of it. And I really like to understand where an artist is coming from creatively in a very specific period of time.
Yeah.
You know, those are the things that I really enjoy. Like, I love knowing that, okay, you know, the Byrds recorded, you know, this song on this day in the lead up to this album. Maybe it didn't make the album, but it helped inform a creative decision that ultimately ended up landing on a specific album.
Yeah.
That kind of, you know, reverse engineering kind of and storytelling is something that has always appealed to me.
There's a CD reissue of Tim by the Replacements that I found really revelatory that came out probably 10, 15 years ago now or something like that.
And, 2008, I think.
Oh, is it? Yeah. So know. You should know, goddammit.
Yeah. Damn
it. Yeah.
Well, I wrote the liner notes for that, so
yeah. So, Bob, you two are a huge fan of the Replacements. We talked about, obviously, you're an authority on it. We talked about this the last time you were on, and so, what does it mean to you to have access to all of this history, to get sort of firsthand, you know, to actually touch and feel these things that no one else really has had been able to? What does that feel like?
Well, it's kind of fascinating. I mean, a lot of this for me is an outgrowth of researching the book, which I did for, you know, almost 7, 8, 9 years from start to finish. And part of what I was doing, I was one of the first people doing it for the first time, really digging into not just the kind of history of the band, but the sort of tactile stuff, you know, records and data and receipts and all this stuff that the sort of the band and its management had. And then going further into the actual catalog, listening to things that, you know, hadn't been heard or listened to, or in some cases found, you know, I found a few things. And so for me, it's just kind of, you know, it's a little bit like peeling an onion, and it just, there's more layers, more and more layers. You think, okay, we've reached a kind of logical endpoint. But I think what keeps it interesting for me is the Replacements, certainly for most of their career, made no two albums that were really alike. And even if you go into the latter half of their career, no two album sort of situations, either the lineup or the circumstances of their recording are similar. And in many cases, they're very much about where the band was at in that moment. So you know, they weren't a band that was just churning out the same record over and over again in the same studio or whatever. I mean, there is a story with each record, and given the personalities and sort of combustible nature of the group, there's usually a very entertaining and kind of explosive story behind each record. And I think what I wanted to do as a kind of historian and a biographer coming out of the release of the book in 2016 was dig a little further and let fans, you know, people who love this music as well, kind of have the privilege of hearing and seeing what I've seen and knowing a little bit more about this band and their creative process, because they weren't a band really that sort of revealed that stuff too much in their lifetime. And even to the sort of first wave of reissues and the Replacements, for compared to most bands of their stature, are very underrepresented until recently in terms of, you know, kind of digging through the archives and catalogs. So we're just kind of doing something that finally is the moment is ripe to do, I suppose, and that's dig into these classic records like Pleased to Meet Me, or dig into the archives at Warner Brothers House, and show the sort of creation stories and the personal stories, and also ultimately the kind of the history that some people are aware of and some people haven't heard before.
Yeah. So you have already done extensive research on the Pleased to Meet Me sessions for your book, Bob, and these liner notes that you've written are fantastic. How much of these liner notes are drawn from that research, and how much of it is fresh and new stuff that you didn't know when you were working on the book?
A good bit of it is fresh. I mean, one of the things that this you know, this set has, which is a 3-disc, 1 LP set that has 55 tracks, and there's 29 tracks that haven't been on there before. One of the major components was the demo session that the band did in 1986. And really what this project, I think the story behind this record is the transformation of the Replacements at kind of the midpoint of their career. They had been together about 7 years. They had put out, signed to Sire in 1985, put out Tim that fall. And the band was sort of in a state of flux, with Bob Stinson, the co-founder and lead guitarist, sort of on his way out of the band. And really that came to a head in the sort of first stirrings of this record of making Pleased to Meet Me. They did a demo session in the summer of 1986, for which Bob was part of the first day or two and then sort of departed, which that event sort of subsequently resulted in him splitting from the group permanently and the Replacements moving on and making the record as a 3-piece. In between that, they very much considered breaking up, you know, with Bob leaving and Paul was going to quit, and then the band was going to break up. And even the start of this record that they made in Memphis in the fall of 86 and early 87 with producer Jim Dickinson was really kind of a referendum on the band. Would the band even be able to survive and continue? And so you talk about kind of the built-in storytelling aspect of a box set. I mean, we really have it with this one, where you see the sort of transformation of the band, you know, at the end of a 7-year run with Bob Stinson, that goes into this sort of unknown period that tracks the record as a 3-piece and then comes out the other side of it at the end, just after the recording, with a new member in Slim Dunlap, who replaced Bob. And that's kind of the next 5 years of the Replacement story. And it's all sort of contained in this 4 or 5 month period in the making of this record.
Yeah, no, it is remarkable. Jason, we've talked a little bit now about what Bob articulated in terms of telling the story of this record. What do these tracks tell us about the story of this record? Bob mentioned there's 55 songs spread over these discs here. What for you are the revelatory moments in terms of digging through the demos and other stuff?
To me, the revelation, the kind of eureka moment, was the discovery of the second batch of demos. That was a truly impactful moment because, you know, as a student of reissue culture and just as a general music fan, listening to the 2008 reissue of Pleased to Meet Me that had a few of the demos, I knew that those were recorded with Bob Stinson. What I didn't realize, and what Bob and I both didn't realize, was that we actually had the full run of demos. So we had, you know, the initial batch that they recorded with Bob, and, you know, the final recordings of the original lineup. And then they took a break for a few days and then came back. And to me, when they came back with, you know, a really, really, really strong set of material and songs that to be demoed, impactful songs that eventually made their way to Pleased to Meet Me, like, that showed me that, you know, this band is a really strong collective and a collective mindset. And in the face of having to, you know, leave one of your brothers behind, literally, to come with such fury and force creatively was a revelation to me. Yeah. And also the discovery of the full initial rough mix of the record that had some additional takes, additional, you know, original mixes, the originally intended track listing, you know, that like those kinds of discoveries are what make a package like this most interesting to me. Because I have to come at it from, you know, a job perspective, but also I always put myself in the seat of what would a fan want here? And to me, this is like, oh man, who knew that there was this much material? Because, you know, we had kind of inklings of stuff that had, you know, dribbled out before on the All for Nothing comp and on the Please to Meet Me deluxe, the expanded edition.
Yeah, yeah.
But to be able to really, you know, create a 3-disc immersion into this one record is something that, you know, I didn't know if it was going to be possible, but we were able to pull it off. And it sounds awesome.
It does. It absolutely does. I want to just go back to what you were saying about dribbling out, because reissue culture often butts heads against bootleg culture. What percentage of the material on this new reissue has circulated in some form or another? I know that in the liners, Bob Mayer, by the way, we should distinguish between Bob Stinson and Bob Mayer whenever we can, for those who may not know. Bob Mayer suggests that a few of the songs that ended up on Please to Meet Me were part of some live sets that the Replacements played, I think, in Europe. So some of these songs have, and demos probably have circulated before, or no? Are you feeling like, no, this is the Ark of the Covenant?
It's a small
percentage overall, I would say. Okay. Because, you know, there were some sets that included some of this material that leaked out that are, you know, from the torrent days I had discovered previously. But
like live performances of them?
No. Some of a handful of the demos had squeaked out before.
How do you think that happens? Because I understand sometimes when like an independent, you know, demos get circulated somehow. Sometimes it's just grassroots. That's the way it happens. The Replacement stuff has got to be under like a vault with like a guard dog.
Well, not at the time. You know, I think it's funny you mentioned that, because one of the Replacements and Paul Westbrook's pet peeves was at the time was kind of bootlegging of things. And it sort of started with this record where there were some outtakes of the actual sessions at Arden. In those days, it was pretty easy. It's like somebody would make cassette dubs for the band to listen to or whatever. And then they share it with a friend or somebody gets it, which is usually by the time you hear it on a bootleg, it's, you know, 5 generations of tape hiss on it. But I mean, we were lucky in that most of this stuff, particularly the demos, there was 3 reels of demos, you know, representing almost a week's, you know, 3-4 days of work. Some of that had been found. An extra reel we came up with, we found. There was one of the songs was like only existed in a cassette form that, you know, that somebody had dubbed to a DAT, so which we managed to clean up. And, you know, and then the stuff that has been bootlegged, you know, as I say, 5th generation hiss has been cleaned up and, you know, in some cases remixed or just redone beautifully. So I would say of that, I mean, it's like 80% of this stuff nobody's heard, and certainly never, and 100% of it never in this clarity. And then, you know, one of the other big strains, and you may mention it later, is in terms of talking about the stakes creatively for the band, one of the things that comes out in this record is that Tommy Stinson, who is the bass player and co-founder of the band, was writing and recording a lot of songs at this time. And only one or two of those have ever been heard or known about. And we found many of them, some not completed, but we've put 4 of those songs on here. So those are things that nobody's ever heard. Nobody's been bootlegged. And so I think it's just, when you talk about kind of an alternate history of what might have been or what they were doing, it just gives you a completely different understanding to know that there are, you know, 4 or 5 really great Tommy Stinson songs from that Please to Meet Me era recorded at Arden, some and some at Blackberry Way in Minneapolis. So I think, you know, the story, you know, of a project like this is you go into it knowing a certain amount, and then some of it is doing the legwork and digging and really pushing. And Jason and I both sort of push people many times to find things or just check one more time or bug the guy at the archive to look in this place. And so I think, you know, to really get to the point that we are with this, to have it be as kind of special as it is with as much new material, previously unheard material, you know, it's a matter of just kind of putting the labor in, and also just being lucky enough now that the archive at Warner Brothers, I think, is in a much better shape, and all the sort of materials are much more accessible and, you know, kind of with modern search methods. So we can kind of locate this reel in this storage facility in this state, you know.
And also, I just want to point out that this was created in the early days of the pandemic. Like, this was totally created in kind of like a solitude kind of mindset
where we
kind of had to be reliant on social distancing and, you know, the hoops and hurdles to jump through to make sure that everyone's safe. But also we need certain like tapes in order to help inform a project like this. So it was a whirlwind ride.
I'm
trying to put it together.
So lucky you found it. I mean, as Bob was talking, I was thinking of that horrible warehouse fire at Universal.
Oh, yeah.
All the things that were lost, I assume stuff that you might have wanted, maybe not for this project, but I'm sure. Jason,
was that purely Universal.
Okay. Yeah. You're not under that umbrella. Okay. Universal just by its very name, Universal sounds like it controls everything. It's very universal. You would think it has all the stuff. So yeah.
Well,
just,
they've acquired a lot of companies.
Yeah.
Over the years,
they named themselves well. Bob, you were talking about Tommy and his role. And one of the things that I learned here, or maybe I read about it in your book and I can't remember, it's been 5 years, give me a break. He wrote a song called Even If It's Cheap, and the opening line of the song is Please to Meet Me, which is again conjured at an awesome record schmooze fest where Tommy is like meeting people and saying, please to meet me, the pleasure is all yours. I just think that's amazing. Like, he was really... It must have been very difficult for Tommy at this point. He had to let his brother go from this band, which he says, you quote him as saying, certain family members would never forgive him for that. And it's obviously a very sad thing now that Bob is gone. But however, this seems to have emboldened him in that point. He really came into his own.
Yeah, he was 19 going on 20 and had been a veteran of the band for 7 years. You know, he started basically playing at 12, 13. And so he was, you know, with his brother, who was this kind of force of nature and, you know, massive personality in the band and creative force in his own way, sort of out, there was room, I think, in a sense, or a hole that needed to be filled. And Tommy really stepped up in that, both in terms of the things he was recording and kind of really just getting his first footing as a songwriter, but they burst, the tracks on here burst with so much energy, and they just have a really incredible, it's like, you know, hearing somebody discover their own talent. And he's such a musical guy in addition to playing bass, you know, he's playing guitar on all this stuff. And he even plays drums, not on this stuff, but he's a drummer as well. So, you know, you're hearing the flowering of somebody who's just a natural musical talent. But then also I think, and Jim Dickinson, the producer of the album, talks about it. Tommy had a great bearing on the direction that the actual album sessions took. You know, again, this was a band that was at loose ends, working as a trio for the first time, sort of unmoored. And Dickinson, I think, you know, was the perfect producer for them at the time in terms of sort of giving them what they need, whether it was distracting them or cajoling them or coddling them or, you know, whatever to get the record out of them. But whenever Jim would say that he was at a loss for what to do, he would sort of look to Tommy and let Tommy's instincts sort of guide the record and guide the process. And so I think, yes, this is in as much as all records are, you know, most of the Replacements records are very much Paul Westerberg centric because he's the principal writer and singer. I think you start to see much more of a Paul Tommy dynamic in this record and in this band. And I think a lot of that also has to do with the way Dickinson treated the rhythm tracks and the sort of force and tightness of the band playing really for the first time as a power trio rather than as a quartet. So, you know, I think one of the engineers is quoted as saying a record is like a pie. If there's four members, you know, you cut it up into four pieces. When there's three members, there's more for everyone. And I think both Tommy and Chris Mars, to a great extent, really stepped up on this record. And again, it's another one of the sort of subplots, if you will, of the making of this album.
Is it wrong for me to say that my new favorite song, maybe of all time, is "All He Wants to Do Is Fish"? I'm very pleased.
It's an awesome song.
It's an awesome song, and it's all the versions here are great, and I love it. I really do. I'm being sincere, and that's a Chris song, right?
Yeah, it's a Chris song, and it had been released, I believe, as a, I can't remember if it came out as a B-side or one of the rarities, but we have a demo version on here that we didn't even know existed. And again, I think the environment, maybe there was just a little bit more freedom or looseness or desperation or whatever it was. And between the demo session and the sessions at Arden, which really were, even though they worked hard, there was a lot of playing going on too. And a lot of exchange with the Arden people, with Dickinson and his engineers, who were all musicians, that I think it brought out different things in the band and allowed for different things to come out. Hence, you have songs by Chris, you have songs by Tommy. You have the band trying different, doing oldies covers in the middle of a session. You know, in one of the demos, even in the demo session where they had enough free time now to kind of play with things, they do almost a kind of calypso version of the song, you know. So
I think
the Replacements were, for the first half of their career, they were making, records pretty quickly in a kind of punk rock, post-punk, indie rock, indie label environment. And, they sort of gradually, once they got to the major labels, became more and more enamored and involved with the process of record making. Not that they were ever comfortable with it, but I think after Tim, for which there isn't a lot of additional material and they didn't do a ton of recording, the next couple records, next three records in terms of Pleased to Meet Me and then also Don't Tell a Soul, there's a ton of recording and a ton of different approaches to the studio and all that stuff. So it's interesting to see them become a kind of band that uses the studio in a way that they don't for the first half of their career.
Yeah.
And it's also the fact that Sire was willing to invest in them as well and mm-hmm. give them the time
right.
as well.
Right.
Because Seymour Stein, founder of Sire Records, he loved that band. And, he gave them the opportunity to be as creative as possible. And you can really see that on Pleased to Meet Me, and you can definitely see that on Don't Tell a Soul, when there was, essentially two passes at recording that record.
Right.
I'm getting the hint that maybe there's another reissue coming, but I'm going to leave that alone for now. Jason, I just want to follow up on a couple of things. First of all, Seymour Stein seems to have wonderful taste, and he seems to get behind really good stuff, or he seemed to, I mm-hmm. should say. Bob invoked the late Jim Dickinson, who produced this record, and there's some great stories and quotes from Jim. Bob, you must have spoke to Jim for your book, I'm gathering, yes?
Yes, I did, although he passed not long after I really sort of started the project, but I knew Jim living in Memphis, Tennessee, as I do, and Jim is a native of the area. I had there's a lot of materials beyond my conversations with him, so I got a really pretty fully informed picture and managed to talk to who are some of the greatest engineers ever in John Hampton and Joe Hardy, who worked on this record, who were staffers at the time at Arden, who've since passed, as have so many of the other kind of session players on this record. But it was really interesting, just to see the kind of union. This is the first time the Replacements had worked outside of their hometown. And really, even though Tommy Ramone had produced their previous record, Tim, they'd done it with their longtime engineer, Steve Felsett. So this is the first time they were kind of literally fish out of water in the South recording with a very high level studio professionals, but who were also kind of on their level sort of philosophically and attitudinally and musically in terms of Jim Dickinson and the crew at Arden. So I think it was, again, that's another sort of subplot of the story, is seeing the sort of mixing and mingling of the Replacements, these sort of Northern Yankees, as the Southerners would refer to them, and these musicians down in Memphis, and the whole atmosphere, which I think sort of informed the process as well.
Yeah, absolutely, Jason. So there's some great quotes and stories about Jim, and one of my favorites from Bob's liner notes. This is a quote from Jim Dickinson: "If it isn't true, it ought to be," which I just thought was very funny. What do you make of the sound Jason, I want to go to you. What do you make of the sound of Pleased to Meet Me? Because as is revealed in these liner notes and I guess in the lore of this album, it is a highly produced affair. It is it was the band's, I guess, first experience with digital recording on some level.
It was.
And Jim, as much as he was like old school, was totally adopting the copy and paste aspects of digital recording. The record has a very particular sound. How would you characterize it, Jason, compared to what they had done before and maybe even what was to come?
I mean, it's a very clean recording, but it's still super loose. You can't shake the looseness out of the Replacements. It's something where, you know, I look at Jim Dickinson as being like, you know, he's like a Southern Trevor Horn at the time. He's got his sampler, you know, he's like, he's playing around and he's totally immersed in audiophile world and really taking a place like Arden and getting it up to the standard of some of the, you know, leading recording studios at the time back in 86.
Yeah.
So I think that it is, you know, I always think that this is the Mats, you know, it's their exile. Because it's all over the place. It's their exile on Main Street. It's all over the place.
You connect him to a guy who's connected to the Stones, Jim Dickinson, interestingly.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
And also, I think it's something where in Arden, you know, you have Dickinson, who has Stones connection. You also have Third Sister Lovers by Big Star that was recorded there. You know, there's a lot of mythology that they're kind of staring at when they're in this location. So for them to rise to the challenge with, you know, a record that, you know, in Matt's circles is, you know, definitely in your top three of favorite Matt's records. I think it's, you know, sometimes it's number one, number two, number three, depending upon the day. he really knew how to get the best out of them and create an environment where they could feel comfortable enough to do that.
Absolutely.
You know, because like Bob said, it's something where they are fish out of water. To me, it's something where, you know, this is also a story about them being fish out of water. You know, Northerners coming down to Memphis and like
with attitudes though too. There's the story of Chris drawing is it Jed Clampett on his suitcase like to make fun of the South?
Yeah.
They brought their attitudes. They've chased producers and record executives, you know, in every city, every environment they're in. They have no reverence for everyone. I find it striking to your points, both of you, that they got along so well with Jim because, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, Jason, but it occurs to me that, Bob, I actually wonder about this from your perspective because like a lot of producers, Jim had to play psychologist with the Replacements, and I find that really interesting. He got them. He got when to leave them alone, and he got when to push them in a way that seemed like he was leaving them alone. Is that fair?
Yeah, Jim's background, I mean, he, as he says in the notes, or one of the engineers says, Jim always said he liked the psychodrama of recording more than he was interested in any technical aspects. That's why Jim very rarely he wasn't coming from an engineer background per se. That's why he always had great engineers on staff. I mean, he was coming much more from a kind of philosophical background. I mean, I think he says in the notes, you know, he's trying to capture your soul on tape. That may not be the artist's intention, but that's his intention. And Jim came from a background of, you know, he was very much from the Sam Phillips school. I mean, he was a student of Sam Phillips. And in a way, Sam was very much about sort of pulling something out of the artist that the artist didn't even know they had in them. And Jim's background was that of, you know, he had been a drama student in college. And then his stated intention before he really got into music was to be a history teacher. And you almost see that playing out because he always had a flair for the theatrical or the psychology of the theater and knew how to deal with his charges in that way. But he was also imparting things to the band. And Paul would say, you know, he would tell us stories about a million and one people from Elvis to Otis Redding, and it would almost distract us. And so he was using his tools as a dramatist and as a teacher to sort of either put them at ease or put them in a position where they had to make a decision or whatever it was, but he was doing all that with a purpose to kind of get what he wanted out of them. And the environment certainly sort of added to that. And as the sessions wore on, Jim would bring in people to kind of fill the, fill the sort of texture, add textures and fill the hole from Bob not being there. You know, there's horns on this record, there's strings on this record. There's all kind, you know, there's piano and organ that Jim's playing on this record that, you know, didn't exist in the sort of replacements universe before. But Jim was very calculated and smart about how he introduced anything he wanted to do. And also I think he knew, having worked with the Stones at their most decadent, having worked with Alex Chilton at his most rebellious, he knew how to handle difficult personalities. And so, you know, as you mentioned, they had gone through a list of would-be and potential producers, some of the replacements were rejected and some who they, you know, didn't want to work with the replacements. And Jim, I really do believe, was not only the perfect person for this time, but really maybe the perfect person for the replacements, you know, in this moment to get them to make the record they needed to, when they were kind of, again, as I say, they were a three-legged table at this point. You know, they had yet to quite figure out what their new form was going to be. And sort of Jim kind of propped them up for much of this recording and got, I think, in a way, you know, you can argue that they have records that are better, but I don't think they have a more sustained record in terms of a performance and in terms of what they're delivering than this record.
I mean, that's arguable. I don't want to get in trouble. I'm not going to say that. You can say that. But I do wonder, we've talked a little bit about the psychology. We've talked about how the band was in a transitional state. I think those of us who follow Paul Westerberg's writing, you get the sense that he's telling stories that are based on real life. But I was kind of really astonished by how much anecdotal stuff there is on this record. Just fragments of conversations. I alluded to Tommy saying "please to meet me" in his own song, but then saying it in real life, and then that even the handshake, the stilted right. handshake with these corporate, you know, people took on new meaning for the, yeah, "please to meet me," that's the title, absolutely, now let's recreate that whole moment. Like, all of that's very right. fascinating to me, and funny and irreverent. Even Alex Chilton, like, the chorus is so funny now that I'm not going to spoil too much. People need to read all this stuff, but it's very funny. However, it's also very dark. Like, this is some of Paul's darkest writing. How is all of this psychological stuff that we've kind of alluded to, in your estimation, Bob, how is it fed into Paul's writing on this record? The songs, there's at least one song, Never Mind, that seems to be directly addressing Bob Stinson. There's a lot right. going on for the band at this point. How would you characterize his mindset at the time?
Well, I'd hate to ever try and characterize Paul's mindset, but it is true. I think, you know, so much of what he wrote about, for the most part, you know, and let it on Tim, there's a couple of examples of sort of songs inspired by a short story by Flannery O'Connor or by, you know, different playwrights, you know, something like Little Mascara, he said. But I think for the most part, and as a rule, Paul's songwriting was very much informed by his own world. And for him at this point, the band was his world, you know, and had been for a number of years. So, you know, you have a lot of songs and they've been signed and had gone through the first sort of stages of becoming a major label band and part of a corporate machine, for better or worse. And I think a lot of these songs are about that, you know, and they split with their manager and original benefactor, Peter Jesperson. And I think if you listen to this record, just in terms of, you know, I don't know, is kind of, he refers to as the state of the Matt's address. You know, it's like, it really is the sort of call and response of, you know, here, we're in trouble for this, our lawyer's on the phone, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah. What are we going to do now?
I don't know.
Yeah. Right. And there's even, you know, should we pack it up? You know, I think it really was addressing whether they were going to sort of stay around as a band. Yeah. And things like IOU. And then he goes back certainly on things like The Ledge, which yeah. I think recalls, you know, at the time, you know, teen suicide clusters were very sort of prominent, but I think this goes even further back based on a kind of personal experience for him,
yeah.
but also just being able to sort of put himself back in that. And then in a weird way, being in Memphis, I think made them, and they tended to be fairly homesick characters easily. You know, that's why they didn't really tour Europe that much or tour around the world, is because they generally like to be in the States and particularly at home. But things like Skyway, which yeah. is very much a Minnesota song, was written and completed in Memphis. And I think in a different circumstance, maybe he wouldn't have put that on. Even Can't Hardly Wait, which had existed in various forms for a number of years, the lyric was really rewritten and finished in Memphis, and was, you know, the crack in the drapes that he refers to is the hotel drapes that they were staying in Midtown Memphis. So I think, you know, environment, you know, Paul says, oh, well, you know, I was recording in a closet. I could have been in Timbuktu or I could have been in Memphis. But being away from home and being in Memphis ultimately, I think, did have an impact on not only what songs he was writing, but what songs he was leaving on. And, you know, there's a lot of great stuff that maybe would have even added to that feeling that was left off. I mean, things that are on this record for the first time or on this box set for the first time, like Run for the Country and Learn How to Fail. These are sort of ballad heavier stuff or slower songs that I think Paul was probably hesitant to put on in the wake of Bob's departure. You know, they didn't want to seem like they were going too soft, kicking out the wild rock and roll guitars. And so I think certain decisions were made. And also that might've been Dickinson too at the time, just trying to make a leaner record. Cause at one point they talked about doing a double, but I think now when you listen to this box set and you can hear everything that's in there, I think you get a much more total picture of, you know, Paul's world and the band's world at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I do appreciate all of this context for that time and place, and the liner notes are truly wonderful. Jason, let's try to sell this thing. Let's tell people more about what is the various sets, because I think you can buy this in sort of different forms, right?
On Rhino.com.
Yeah.
There are some exclusive bundles.
Yeah.
That basically we have three different bundles. You get the box set itself, which is, again, it's 180 gram LP inclusive of the rough mix of the album that has a totally different track listing and some alternate takes included. Plus you have three CDs included in the package. First disc is the album remastered by the great Justin Perkins, mm-hmm. who handled all the mastering on Dead Man's Pop. Plus all the assorted B-sides and promo-only mixes that were released around the time. There's a Jimmy Iovine mix of Can't Hardly Wait.
Yeah, I saw that.
Never really been widely distributed. So yeah. We wanted to, you know, fully kind of contextualize the officially released stuff from the time period on disc one.
May I interrupt just for a moment?
Yeah.
What was the context? Maybe it's a Bob question. I don't know, but Jason, I'm sure you know too. What was the context to have Jimmy Iovine do a mix of that song? How did that come about?
Radio campaign for Can't Hardly Wait.
I see. Okay. And Jimmy worked for who at the time?
He was just an independent producer and remixer at that time before he became a media mogul. But I think the replacements management wanted to see, you know, if they could sort of get a slightly different radio mix. You know, at that time, that was very much kind of in vogue thing to do, was to remix a song for radio. You can't really, it's not that much different, but I think in a weird way, it would set up what they did with the next record, which they handed off to the entire thing to a professional mixer and Don't Tell a Soul. But anyway, sorry, Jason, Andrew.
No. And part of that is kind of, you know, this series of reissues, you know, we're trying to tell a larger story, and I wanted to include that because it does help inform some of the decisions that were made for Don't Tell a Soul,
right,
and eventually kind of help inform the kind of revisionist version that we put out as Dead Man's Pop. But anyway, so that's disc one. Disc two, all of the demos from Blackberry Way recorded in 1986. It's 20 tracks. It is killer. Is totally killer.
Yeah.
You're hearing embryonic versions of some really, really great tracks. A lot of them not heard before, and some really fiery
songs as well.
Yeah, some Tommy songs. I mean, Awake Tonight. Whenever Bob and I first heard that song, we lost it because it was like, you know, it's like a legit like road worn faces song.
It
sounds amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And it really is kind of a what if moment.
Yeah.
If, you know, if those songs had more legs to them and were maybe taken into the studio. And then disc three, you have the rough mix on CD, plus all of the studio outtakes from the Pleased to Meet Me session. So you have stuff that's come out previously on the All for Nothing compilation, like Birthday Gal, Till We're Nude, and Beer for Breakfast, plus some completely unreleased songs like Run for the Country, Learn How to Fail, a great Tommy song, Trouble on the Way, that, you know, we were able to really put together a really nice mix, and it sounds awesome. So there's all that. That's just the box set. Plus all the bundle stuff is t-shirt, promotional placemat. They did a promotional placemat for Please Meet Me whenever it first came out. We've reproduced that for this box.
Because they're the mats? Because they're the mats.
Yeah, because they're the mats. Yeah.
Got that
plus,
one.
Yeah, plus a tote bag, iron-on patch. There's also a cassette that is inclusive of an hour-long interview that was originally released in bits and pieces as a promotional 12-inch single. Whenever the album originally came out, but this is like a full hour-long conversation where Paul goes into detail about the recording of Please to Meet Me and, you know, a kind of a track-by-track detail of the songs on Please to Meet Me. It's really, really fun. And you can either get it in red or blue cassette. Take your pick.
We give you a choice.
Okay.
Yeah, and then... what else is there? Bumper sticker, because you want to. I want everyone to show how much they care.
Get it on your car.
It's one of the things that I think we're most excited about. Both of us, this record has been come out as on vinyl. You know, the original album has been done in a couple of vinyl pressings over the last, you know, 6-7 years. And, you know, blue colored vinyl, etc. And those are all from the 2008 remastering of the original album. We were very lucky this time to remaster the original album, kind of using Jim Dickinson's original instructions. We consulted with his son, Luther, who plays in the North Mississippi All-Stars, because there was always a feeling that at least the CD versions and the digital versions of this never quite sounded the way everybody remembered it in the studio. And so we went with Justin Perkins, who's our mastering guy, who does all this great work and is a fan himself. And he really got it to sounding like, you know, it would have been sounding like in 1986 coming out of the speakers at Art Studios.
Yeah. Just in terms it's never sounded better.
Yeah, so it's not quite featured, you know, on the vinyl because we put that out, and so we put the alternate mixes on the vinyl. But, you know, I think for folks who get this to be able to hear that record kind of as good as it's ever sounded is kind of a treat as well.
Well, I have the because I'm a weasel, I got the MP3s at least in advance, and even those sound great. And so, I mean, even because they're MP3s. Sorry, I didn't. Was that a backhanded? Sounds great, guys. Sounds great. They're just little. They're MP3s, so they're only going to sound so good. But I noticed the difference for sure. We've been talking about this record, and we're obviously missing some people that might have some insights here. Bob or Jason, I'm not sure which one of you might be in the greatest contact with either Tommy or Paul or Chris, who seems to have ghosted. What is their relationship with this project? What is their relationship, do you figure, with all this material at this point in their lives? I'm going to go to Bob first.
I think benign indifference is the good is the good way to put it. Well, no, obviously nothing happens in Replacements World without the sort of approval of the band, which for most intents and purposes is Paul and Tommy. And I talk to Tommy on a regular basis, talk to Paul through his manager on a regular basis. And, you know, we started what we didn't know was going to be essentially a series 3 years ago with the release of Live at Maxwell's 1986, which was a multi-track recording of the band, really kind of at the peak of during the Tim tour that had languished in the vaults for 30 years. There you go.
For those listening, I just showed off my copy.
So, you know, we put that out just almost as a trial balloon to see, like, what is the audience for this kind of stuff? Well, what would the response be? And the response was pretty overwhelming and positive. And so it allowed us to say, hey, well, you know, there's other stuff in the archive, other stuff in the vault that we want to do if the band wants to do it. And the next thing we did was Dead Man's Pop, which was kind of a reimagining of really the release of Don't Tell a Soul as the band had intended with its original mix and another live album from the era and so forth as a multi-disc box set, which was something to have that record sound the way the band had intended was always something I think the band wanted and something in particular Paul wanted. So we did that. And with this one, you know, we're, again, a great response. So we're sort of rolling. You know, the Replacements are not guys who generally look back and they are probably not the best stewards of their own catalog or legacy. But I think in so much as they realize they are an important band and important bands need to have their legacies and their catalogs tended to, they've basically given the green light to me and to Jason here to kind of do that on their behalf. And certainly Rhino is the company that owns or controls the entire Replacements catalog, including their Quintone stuff. It makes sense. It's all under one roof. There's a sort of cooperation in terms of that. And really, again, as I said, of any band you can think of the kind of importance of the Replacements, they're probably the most under-anthologized, under-reissued, under, you know, until we started to do it. And we're not trying to do this stuff willy-nilly. We've managed to do several projects in a row here now, but all of them are basically creating new content. And the way we look at it, and certainly the way we feel with Maxwell's, no question, that is a piece of their catalog, you know, in the main. I mean, they have never, they had a band for a band who was so recognized for their live shows and their performances to not have a live record out, you know, an official live record out, was something we wanted to address. And so, you know, the response to that was so terrific that we just tried to do this in a creative way. And, you know, as long as there's music out there and content out there in the archive that sort of validates this and stories within their catalog that make this worth doing, I think we're going to do it. And, you know, so far the band has been cooperative in their own way. You know, it's not like Jimmy Page, who's personally, you know, remixing everything and signing off on every mix, but you know, they, you know, we can't do anything without the band wanting to do it. So far, you know, they've been willing to in their own Replacements-y way.
Well put, well put. So on that note, a couple of questions. First, Jason, what is sort of next in your, if you could do anything with the Replacements catalog next, what would you want to work on? Let's put it in a way that suggests that you don't admit that you were probably already working on something, but gives you.
Well, let's see here. How can I say? I'll there's two projects. Oh, there's three. Well, I'll go over two. There's two that I would love to see come to light at some point. One would be to remix Tim at some point. You know, I think that has been something that, you know, everyone loves that record, but the biggest gripe about that record is the way that it sounds. Some people think that it sounds great. A lot of people think it sounds like it could be improved upon. I want to at least have the opportunity to see if we can improve upon it. As Bob said, you know, there's not a lot of additional material from that time period. So that kind of makes a huge expansive box set, you know, more difficult.
For Tim, so that's for something Tim, that just for Tim, you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. Just for Tim.
What do people complain about exactly? Cause I listen to lots of records and I kind of can discern when things sound good or sound not so good. Tim has never, I mean, I guess in my mind, the most recent version is that 2008 reissue, I guess, which would have been remastered.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. It's like the situation we had with the Dead Man's Pop, where we basically had Matt Wallace, who was the producer of the album, finish his mix that he had started back in 1988. Now, most people were very receptive to that, the overwhelming majority, because that record sounded different than Replacements records. You know, people expected at the time it was very glossy, it was for radio, it had a lot of effects, a lot of, as it turned out, a lot of things were dialed out of the record that were intended. And so that was really kind of fulfilling the band's creative thing. I think with Tim, you know, there was at the time and still is within the band and also within the fan base, complaints that it doesn't sound as full or as powerful as the Replacements sounded at the time. And the evidence of that, I think, is when you listen to Live at Maxwell's and you listen to some of the Tim songs presented there.
Right.
And it may have been, again, a question of, this is the first time they were working with a major label. They had a producer in Tommy Ramone, who's a great producer, but he was paired with someone who wasn't his normal engineer. And maybe there was some disconnect there. So that's one of those things that I think in the bigger scheme of things, you know, there's not a lot, because the Replacements, for the most part, everything was cut and dried in terms of how they recorded and what they did. And they're a band with very few regrets in that regard creatively. I mean, they, for the most part, put out the records they wanted to put out the way they did. The two kind of exceptions were the mix on Don't Tell a Soul, which was kind of a compromise on their part to try and sort of have some success that the band may continue, which didn't quite turn out that way.
Yeah.
Whereas with Tim, I think it's just a question of, well, it doesn't quite sound as powerful as they sounded at the time, which again is evidenced on the Maxwell's thing.
And also the drums. I personally have a problem with the way the drums sound.
I'm a drummer. Are you a drummer?
I am.
Wow, we're drummers. Okay, yeah, I could
drummer complaint.
I could so see that's that. Something, yeah, I could see
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so that's something where I want to just see if there's you know, an opportunity for that. And another project would be, you know, Sorry Ma is 40 next year. You know, maybe we can try and do something with that. I think that, you know, the thing, we really kind of take this piecemeal where, you know, we look at how well each one performs, and then we decide, okay, what do we have? A, do we have an opportunity to continue? And if we're going to continue, what do we want to do next? And that's kind of a collective decision between myself, Bob, and all the other parties that are involved.
So nothing's in stone yet, but you have some ideas of where you'd like to go.
Yeah, there's always ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's kind of, and also All Shook Down, that would be a great record to expand upon because there's a great collection of demos that Paul recorded at that time.
Well, that's what I was going to get at. Are your ideas born of archival knowledge that you have that some of us don't? Like you've obviously thought about these projects from the point of view of like, I was going through the stuff for Please to Meet Me and guess what I found for these other records, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're kind of, there are certain records where there's not a wealth of material.
Right.
So you have to get creative or you have to potentially look at, what tapes someone might have or, stuff like that. That's kind of where it all kind of comes together. With something like Please to Meet Me, we did have the good fortune of there was a lot of material in the vault that we could listen to and pull from.
Yeah. Well, okay. Finally, I'm going to ask you for perspectives on a thing that you can't really speak to, but you might be able to a little bit. Some of us were very lucky to see a version of The Replacements come back. What was it? Seven years ago and play some shows. And that kind of stopped, I think, dramatically on some level, as anything with The Replacements. Every stop is somewhat strange and dramatic. What is your perspective on that band's ability to function again in some way? Bob, you talk to Tommy regularly. Let me ask you this. What do you think? Are we ever going to see the likes of them playing or doing something again?
My answer to that is sort of the same as when prior to them reuniting in 2013 is it never seems likely and it's always kind of a long shot, but sort of predicting what Paul or Tommy might do or be willing to do at any given moment is sort of a fool's errand.
Okay.
I know even for those shows in 2013, where I had heard, at that point they were getting offers to reunite every year, for 10 years. And it looked like that there was no chance that was going to happen at all. And then at the last minute they decided, yeah, let's do it. So, they did it tours for, 2 years on the festival circuit and then headlining shows. And then it fell apart just as abruptly. And so, it's one of those things where it could start again or maybe that was it. And it was the last go round, it was pretty great. I think universally sort of well regarded victory lap for them. So,
okay. No rumblings of anything. Was everyone on this call today at the Toronto show? Cause I was,
I don't think Jason, were you there?
I couldn't bring myself to go see the reunion shows because what? I loved them so much that I didn't want to be disappointed or have the opportunity to be disappointed. I lived in New York at the time and I had a ticket to Forest Hills.
Oh my God, you blew it.
A cart. I know. I totally blew it. But it's one of those things where you love something so much that you don't want it to kind of crush the idea of what you have in your head, I've loved this band for so long, and knowing all the players involved, I knew it was a knock out of the park, but when faced with the decision to go or not to go, I decided to not. And I forever kick myself for that.
So yeah, Jason was a younger man there, Vish, and he hadn't quite realized, he was still dogmatic and thinking these things. But now, I was an older man. I knew I don't care. I'm going to go see it, whether it's good, yeah, bad, or indifferent. And it, as it turned out, it was pretty great. And Forest Hills might have been the best show.
Oh, dude, I know, and that's the thing that kills me because just for a little bit of background, like I had seen certain acts previously that I placed on a pedestal in my mind and had been completely disappointed.
There was
proof of don't hold something that high because they're people just like everyone else. They can have an off night. but it's it was something where just I couldn't bring myself to do it.
I'm not going to disparage you for this decision, because the replacements are an odd entity in this regard, because it's not the original lineup that we all saw. I do firmly believe in band chemistry. So, and I will say that the bands that I used to see in the 90s that came back in the late 2000s when that was popular, or rather the early part of the 2000s when it was popular to reunite, I thought they were better. I think as people, you're a bit more relaxed. Your psychology, you're at ease with each other a bit because you got all that angst out of your system, so you get along better, and that translates into that band chemistry thing. So, yeah, I can see that. The whole, never meet your heroes philosophy that you're employing for seeing a version of the Replacements play. But to Bob's point, the Toronto show I saw was wonderful, and I'm very glad I went. And I've talked to other people who are Replacements fans. They say the exact same thing as you. I couldn't bring myself to go. I thought it would be a disaster. The band's history more than for those of us who never got what I mean? Yeah.
Which is hilarious considering what I do now.
Do you know?
So it's like I kind of, like that like karmic element, like I'm being repaid in like different ways.
Well, let me ask you this, and you don't have to spill too many beans, but were any of those shows captured properly? Recorded?
Yes, they were, but I don't think the release of those is imminent.
Okay. I love speaking in code about the Replacements. This is fun.
No, I mean, I think, they did professionally record, because I know my friend Rick Fuller was kind of led the crew that shot them. They shot the first three, Toronto, Chicago, and Denver, too, I believe. And Minneapolis, and their headlining show in Minneapolis. So there's four shows that they did record. I think, probably the one thing you can take, the fact that those haven't been released, means that maybe they might tour again someday, because they don't want to sort of,
spill the beans.
Paul is very particular about sort of preserving the mystery. And so I think that's some of it. But at the same time, obviously the powers that be thought, well, this is a historical thing. Let's record it for posterity. So who knows? At some point it may come out, but I wouldn't hold your breath for that, but don't hold your breath for anything, too long.
Yeah. Yeah. Jason, have you seen or heard any of these professionally recorded, reunion tour shows?
Yes.
Okay. So that's why you're so angry. You actually were
I had friends who went to the Forest Hill show. I've watched stuff on YouTube. I know what it was.
Yeah.
And I know that was one of the shows. I should have gone.
Toronto, you missed a pretty kick-ass Stooges and Rocket from the Crypt show as well. Those were all, that was a great day. And Dinosaur Jr. played. That was a great, I had a really good time, I will say.
I'm from the South. I'm actually from Tennessee.
Oh.
And whenever I, in the early 2000s, late 90s and stuff, whenever I was in high school and in college and, trying to seek out additional culture to just go see shows and stuff like that. Like the Stooges never came to the South.
Right.
So it's like, I could never see those reunion shows. So it's kind of like whenever I moved to New York, I had the ability to go see some of those bands because everyone comes through there. Also, I have the good fortune of this living in LA where, everyone's going to come through whenever live music comes back. Should have gone, man.
All right. I think we've beaten Jason up enough about this. I really appreciate this conversation. Let me give you this opportunity. If either of you has anything else you want to say, I'm going to ask Jason probably to tell us, those listening, where they can learn more about the set and the reissue generally. But just final thoughts about either Pleased to Meet Me or Bob, if you want to also share anything you're working on next, I'd love to hear that. So let's go to Bob. Bob, final thoughts what's next?
Sure. Well, actually, as we are recording this, I received my physical copy of the box set, which I had not seen.
Oh, dude, right on.
Wow.
So it's very exciting for me. And, the thing I've kind of taken away looking at it, how beautiful the package is in terms of both how it's been designed by Mike Joyce at Stereotype in New York is in thinking just this kind of by accident, as I say, we started this in 2017 thinking it was a one-off and we'd be lucky if we got to do another one and not knowing. And we've sort of developed this into a series. And as Jason and I say, we sort of think of it along the lines of the Dylan bootleg series, where it's not chronological or necessarily in order, but sort of jumping around from different interesting periods, you know, for a band that had 12 years. I mean, as much as you can sort of jump around in there. But one of the things I'm really excited about is just people to actually hear this. You know, the Replacements fans are very dogmatic, and I think we have proven over the last couple of releases that, you know, if you're going to buy something that we've put together, it's going to be worth checking out, and that the band has okayed. And, you know, we've been very lucky. The guy who does all our mixing is a guy named Brian Keough, who has produced Fiona Apple, who works for The Who. He's like one of the top remix guys, you know, in terms of and sound guys. He literally wrote the book on the Beatles equipment. I mean, it's like to have somebody like that at our disposal to sort of work on this stuff. Same thing with Justin Perkins from Mystery Room Mastering, who did all this stuff. And then again, our designers, and we have, you know, and I'm very fortunate to work with Jason on all this stuff, and the band and its management. It's like, it really is kind of like, I'm not someone who gets sort of overly proud. I'm always self-critical of the things, but even though we didn't plan it this way, this is going to make a really very cool series of releases and sets and archival stuff, and just with some really high level people behind it that we're very lucky, and that the band, frankly, is very lucky to have, because, you know, this isn't Led Zeppelin, but what we try and put as much care and thought and, you know, detail and love into this as you know, your Led Zeppelin reissues and your Beatles reissues. So hopefully people appreciate that. And yeah, that's about all I wanted to say.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. And in terms of your own future work, is there anything you're working on that you want to talk about?
Just I'm working on my golf game, because I can't play basketball anymore because of the pandemic here in this country. But no, I'm trying to figure out another book topic. But, you know, I've sort of been stuck in Replacements world for an extended period between the book and then the paperback. And then, you know, obviously these various projects. And there's been some interest in sort of you know, developing the book into something as a, you know, an adaptation theatrically or cinematically or television. So, you know, so I'm still kind of, you know, just when I thought I was out, I keep getting pulled back into Replacements world. But you know, I'm not sad about it, because, you know, I've had time over the last few years to think about a follow-up book and look at different topics and subjects and even have some discussions with people. And really, there are very few stories that I am as passionate about, or bands whose music I'm passionate about and whose story has so many layers and angles and pockets that you could just sort of get lost in. So I'm very happy to still be kind of dealing with this stuff. And until I'm sick of it, then I'll be sick.
Well, you are clearly the godfather of the Replacements, so it's nice to talk to you about that. And Jason, what about, so two things, Jason, anything you want to talk about in terms of Rhino World or anything you're working on? And two, can you direct people to get more information about the Please to Meet Me reissue?
Sure. Well, one thing that just got announced yesterday is the Grateful Dead's American Beauty Angel Share collection. It's a collection of outtakes from American Beauty in celebration of its 50th anniversary. I had the good fortune of actually working with Brian Keough on that collection. So we released some demos at the beginning of October, and the full 56-track comp comes out mid-October.
Sweet.
So that's something that's I'm very, very proud of. As far as where people can learn more information about Please Meet Me, you can go to rhino.com. You can see all the bundles that I discussed. And also, I just want to point out that independent record stores, if you get Please to Meet Me, this new deluxe box set out October 9th, at an independent record store, a participating independent record store, you will get a hand buzzer. We kind of riffed off of the original
the handshake.
87. Yeah, the handshake. You know, we wanted to do something special just for independent record stores, because independent record stores are, you know, the bread and butter of kind of what helped a band like the Replacements get to the level that they're at. So, you know, you have an entire suite of options, you know, that you can get this great box set from.
Okay.
And it's, you know, as, yeah, It's great. And I think that everyone will be, I think everyone will be really, really, really surprised.
Yeah, Vish, I'll tell you, it's a lot better to be able to, when something is actually great, to come out here and hustle it and say it's great. It's I'm much more confident doing that when I actually know it's great than when it's terrible. Yeah.
Well, by the same token, I have the freedom to cover whatever I want, and I wouldn't be talking to you guys if this thing was a piece of garbage. So it is really, really wonderful. Again, go to rhino.com and bundle up, as the saying goes. So this is sort of weird because you guys aren't in the band, but I usually go out on a song. I usually ask people, do you think, I don't know who here can say, and let's all get in trouble together, why not? Would it be permissible to go out on a song from this box set? Jason, I'm going to go to you. You're the label guy. What do you think? Is there something we can go out on? And if so, do you want to pick it?
Yeah, why not? I would go with, let's see here. Go with the demo of IOU.
Okay. Why did that come to mind?
Because that sounds awesome. And it also it gives you kind of a peek. You know, if you know and love this record, it's track one, side one. And it kind of shows you the alternate storytelling and an alternate peek into the making of the record that, you know, we kind of wanted to display within the box set. So my pick would be the demo of IOU.
Okay, Bob, you okay with that?
Yeah, no, I agree. That's a good choice.
I like it too because it harkens back to our painful conversation about Jason missing Iggy and the Stooges and the Replacements.
Exactly.
Got a little bit of an Iggy illusion.
Oh
yeah,
dude, totally, 100%.
This is the demo of IOU from the wondrous album "Pleased to Meet Me" by the Replacements. Jason Jones, Bob Mayer, thank you so much for making time for me and for talking about the Replacements. And I wish you both the best of luck with everything going forward.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Very special thanks to Bob Mayer and Jason Jones for going on this deep dive into The Replacements and their excellent album, Pleased to Meet Me, on this, the 569th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available on all Apple and Google platforms and other things as well. Spotify, there's some of the episodes are up on YouTube. It's all over the place. Find it, or it may find you somehow, I guess. I don't know how that would work exactly. It's not like some kind of thing that searches out people, but still, you can find it. It's called Creative Control. If you can't find an episode that you're actually looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my semi-regularly scheduled newsletter, please visit my website, vishkhanna.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook or follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative or follow me directly at vishkhanna. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast's existence. Please, $6 or more gets you exclusive content, so if you're not getting enough from the show itself and you want a little bit extra, $6 or more at Patreon gets you more stuff. Otherwise, you're just supporting the show. You're saying, good job, Vish. If it wasn't for you, I don't know what I would do with myself and my ears and my brain. You are filling them all with great stuff, and I'd like to give you a little small token of my appreciation every month. Well, maybe I'll give you $2 a month, $3, $4. It could be $5. It could be $6. It could be $7. It could be $9. I skipped some numbers there, but you know what I mean. It could be anything you want, and then you can change it. If you don't like what you're doing, you can change it. Most people go up. I will say I really appreciate that. Most people, when they adjust, they go up. I don't know how they do it, but it's great, and I appreciate it again. Patreon.com/creativecontrol if you, too, would like to support the show. Thanks again to liveatmasseyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by great Canadian artists. They support the show. Also, for their in-kind support of the show, Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. Oh, my friend Jim Guthrie, he lets me use some music for the show. You can learn more about Jim and his great work at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode with Bob Mayer and Jason Jones. In case you're interested, Bob was on the show in 2016. I believe it was episode 262 that we talked about The Replacements and became Replacements friends. His book, Trouble Boys, is still one of my favorite rock and roll books. So if you haven't read it yet, check that out. And yeah, thanks for listening to this episode. Thanks for listening to up to this point even. And I hope you will subscribe and follow the show and tell your friends to do the same things so you can keep tabs on Creative Control. I must leave you now. I will talk to you soon. Thanks again. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.